This is the Mike Garrigan Podcast.
Welcome to episode 3 of 12 in the 2017 podcast series from MikeGarrigan.com. My name is Mike Garrigan. As you may or may not know, I've gone back to school to work on a law degree. This episode is a reflection on my experience as a non-traditional student in the second semester of law school. Nothing in this show is intended as legal advice, nor should it be construed as legal advice. Also, while I am a student at Wake Forest University, everything expressed in this episode is my responsibility and does not represent the views of anyone except me, unless noted. Quote, "The end of man is knowledge, but there is one thing he can't know. He can't know whether knowledge will save him or kill him. He will be killed, all right, but he can't know whether he is killed because of the knowledge which he has got or because of the knowledge which he hasn't got and which, if he had it, would save him." End quote. Robert Penn Warren, All the King's Men. The spring semester began with a chill. January 9th invited 10 inches of snow, mostly powder. The school administration canceled school that Monday, and we began on Tuesday. Universities tend to be less neurotic about canceling classes due to bad weather when compared to other educational institutions. The county public schools, on the other hand, where my daughter Ivy attends, they err heavily on the side of caution. Now, she was out of school for most of the first week that I was back at school, and finding childcare for her on those days where I had to be at school and her school was closed proved to be somewhat of an extracurricular challenge. Something came together, as it always does. Being a parent in law school gives the advantage of offering a province that exists completely outside of the internal world of a law student. I say internal because while it is true that, you know, we're in a section of 40 students, the journey itself is a solo mission, and parenting is sort of like a grounding wire in an electrical storm. And at the same time, the storm rages on and stops for no one. That first day of school, I drove the back roads, crusted with ice and packed snow, and that morning I heard an uncharacteristic scraping from under my car, which, if you've seen my car, you know it's fairly old and closing in on 200,000 highway miles. I hoped for caked powder and nothing more to be causing the sound, but what I got was some kind of protective polymer undercarriage cover that rasped upon the ice in the road. I tore it from the underside, threw it in the trunk, and proceeded to school. I still haven't replaced it. I don't know what it is. It's probably something important, but I don't know. The climate in the hallways was similarly cold, but not because of the weather. Some have described the return after the first semester break as one of the darkest times in all of law school. I agree. When we arrived for the first semester, we were all equal, but now we each had a number assigned to us. Many tell you that the numbers don't mean much, but they do. Well, I guess in terms of job potential and prescient income, these numbers do matter, but in the grand scheme of things, the numbers don't mean much. But the thing is, in law school, you don't exist within the grand scheme of things. You're down in it, as Trent Reznor once said. The excessive workload and lack of time in which to complete it all certainly warped my perception to where I know I placed a value on my number. I would be beyond disingenuous to say that I didn't care about my grades, but thankfully somebody, somewhere, made the unwritten rule that one of the things you never talk about is your grades and your rank. It's the first rule of Fight Club in law school. And by and large, it would appear that everyone has followed that rule. The oddity of that first week waned after coursework picked up. This second semester, we continued with our foundational doctrinal classes, which included the second semesters of civil procedure and contracts, as well as the first semester of constitutional law and a 4-credit-hour property course. And all that means is we had 4 hours of class per week in property, and the other classes were usually 3-hour classes. We also took the second semester of legal analysis, writing, and reasoning, which is lawyer for short, and that involved a number of assignments, which worked up to a 14-page appellate brief. Property law involves the possession of things, ideas, and land. The law divides itself nicely between personal possession, intellectual property, and real estate. Our course was about 25% personal property, 5% intellectual property, and 70% real property. The, quote, real, end quote, in real estate is a derivation of royal or real, real property. The American conception of property law comes from the British tradition, which emerged a long time ago, right after the Norman invasion. You see, William the Conqueror, he had a problem. After invading England, he didn't have a way to pay his army, but he did have a tremendous amount of land, so he paid them in land. And property then became infeudated and sub-infeudated within the feudal system to where the parcels of land became known as, quote, fees, end quote. And while the law has generally evolved out of medieval terminology and other areas, for whatever reason, the nomenclature of estates and property hasn't changed much. The undisputed heavyweight foe of law school, the big bad, is the nefarious rule against perpetuities. And, for one else, this brutal mental exercise often happens in the spring semester. We tackled it near the end of January. The rule against perpetuities is a medieval concept that limits the remote transfer, or what they call in school the divestment of property, in certain situations, often when the person or people who are to inherit the land are either unknown or there's some condition that may or may not occur before they can take the land. The rule itself is a bit of a tongue twister. It says, quote, no interest is valid unless it must vest, if at all, not later than 21 years after some life and being at the creation of the interest, end quote. So basically, if you have a conveyance of land, let's say to Murray for life, and then to Murray's children for life, and then to Murray's oldest living grandchild, and Murray has no children or grandchildren, the interest to Murray's grandchildren is void because it is impossible that after 21 years after Murray dies, Murray's children may not have shuffled loose this mortal coil and the interest will have neither vested or failed. If that sounds confusing, it's because it is, and it's something we all had to master. The most interesting case we read this semester was Kelo versus City of New London from 2005. In that case, the Supreme Court decided that a municipality was justified in condemning private property and giving it to another private entity if it served some legitimate public purpose. There, most of New London was economically depressed and a company wanted to come in and set up shop. The city ended up taking several houses, with compensation, of course, but what happened was the company that was to take over the area, their plans fell through and there was no public purpose that was actually realized. In early 2017, Little Pink House, a movie starring Catherine Keener, premiered, and this movie tells the true life story of this controversial case, and I really can't wait to see it. I hope it comes to Netflix or something soon. A little context here. When Collapsus was on tour, my band, from 2000, we were on tour, we played New London, this city where basically the government took sections of it from citizens. We played New London, And it was 2 or 3 years before this taking happened. I remember a lot of the clubs in the New England area in general being slightly rougher than the clubs in the Deep South, but I recall New London being not unlike any other New England town we played. And with the radio play we were getting, I imagine we had about 100 people at like a 200-person venue. So for my limited exposure of New London, I can't say with any certainty that it really was all that depressed. And I don't know that a town could go downhill that fast to justify completely gutting it. Just my perspective on what happened there. New London, the New London case is quite controversial. So this other class, the second class we took that was new for us was constitutional law. And constitutional law deep dives into vast interpretations of the holiest of holy American documents, the Constitution. And this course began with a brief overview of the Constitution, which included a short and very interesting foray into the Articles of Confederation, followed by a limited discussion of five discrete topics: incorporation, equal protection, substantive due process, state action, and the First Amendment. And our professor favored a historical approach to the Constitution, which is likely the only cogent MO for this multifaceted conundrum of case law, synthesis, and scrutiny. Before this class, whenever I read a Supreme Court opinion, I often made note that the justices sure did discuss the 14th Amendment a lot. And what I learned is that the 14th Amendment is what allows the Bill of Rights to apply to the states. And I didn't know this before taking the class. I mean, initially, what I understood was that the Constitution was this Federalist document, but I didn't know that it didn't have anything to do with a state's power in the beginning. And what we learned was that one of the conditions of the Confederate states being readmitted to the Union after the Civil War was passing this 14th Amendment, which essentially served as what many constitutional law scholars call, quote, the Second American Revolution, end quote. And one of the more interesting cases that we studied was Griswold versus Connecticut from 1965, where Justice Douglas offered this eloquent textual argument where he said that the text of the Bill of Rights emits these penumbras of liberty, which show how the Bill of Rights can be reasoned to be incorporated by reference through the word liberty in the 14th Amendment. Now, con law, as we called it, had the most reading of any course I've ever taken. This is including the dense literature and American studies courses I took as an undergrad. Our professor likened the experience to running a marathon, which, having run several, I think is an accurate analogy. But I would add that instead of your legs turning to sand around mile 20, here in con law, your brain actually stops working sometime after Easter, and like a marathon, something happens and you break through the wall and you finish as strong as you can. I think we all did the best we could, but there came a point where I would, for example, confuse Justice Powell with Justice Blackmun on some obscure enforcement by appropriate legislation cases. I walked away from con law having grown in three ways. And first, I feel like I now have an appreciation for what our professor called the legal pendulum. And on the first day of class, he drew a picture of a grandfather clock with a swinging pendulum. And he noted that when you read a single case, you are essentially taking a picture of the law as it is at the moment that the case is decided. But after reading the width and depth of legal reasoning that we would read, we would kind of have an idea of which way that pendulum was swinging. It's very insightful. And second, I feel like I have an understanding of the First Amendment with a sufficient intelligent detail. I'm not saying I've mastered it, but recently I looked up the case Soundgarden versus Eikenberry, which dealt with the constitutionality of a statute from Washington called the Erotic Sound Recording Statute from the early 90s. And here, Soundgarden, Hart, Pearl Jam, and Sir Mix-a-Lot, among others, claimed that the statute was a form of prior restraint and therefore a facially invalid statute. The Washington Supreme Court agreed, and before this class, I could tell you what the band sounded like that brought this case and discussed their albums, but I didn't know why these bands were involved in this suit or really clearly what the issue was about. And after I took con law, I understand that, well, there's certain types of speech that are protected and some kinds that are not protected, like obscenity. And because this statute banned, quote, erotic, end quote, music, some of which is arguably not obscene, it banned protected speech. And as a second punch, prior restraint is never okay. That's something we talked about. The court would rather judge the speech itself before telling people that they can't record erotic music. And a footnote, between writing this reflection and actually recording it, it so happened that Chris Cornell, the lead singer of Soundgarden, and the likely proponent of seeing this case to the Supreme Court, tragically committed suicide. And I think among the scores of gifts that Cornell gave to society, one perhaps unsung act of service was protecting freedom of expression for musicians. I think it sucks that he's dead, and that'll be a topic for the next show. But third, I feel like I've taken, I guess what I would call a theoretical test drive in the American machine, and I've gotten the opportunity to look under the hood. And the complex engine design has this method that really never before made much sense to me. And our professor often made the comment something to the effect of, quote, last summer when you were at the neighborhood barbecue talking about gun rights, gay marriage, and abortion, you probably had an opinion, but you couldn't articulate why the court, in a historical sense, decided those issues the way it did, when it did, and what likely results will precipitate given the current court, end quote, something like that. Con law felt almost like an intellectual privilege, for which I am most grateful to have taken. The second semester of contracts dealt with what happens with an agreement after it is formed. We considered implied terms, avoidance doctrines, excuses to performance, modification, conditions, breach, and damages. Now, if the first semester was more mechanical, this second semester was a bit squishier. Under a given set of facts, for example, one court may decide one way and another court may decide a different way. Squishy. So many good cases peppered the semester that I just can't pick one as my favorite. Locke versus Warner Brothers is a classic within entertainment law. This case involved Sandra Locke, who had been married to Clint Eastwood, and after their relationship dissolved, Locke maintained a contract with Warner Brothers, where Warner Brothers had discretion to produce whatever films Locke proposed to the studio. And it turned out that the people that she dealt with at Warner Brothers had no intention of ever exercising their discretion. And here, the court found a breach of the implied obligation of good faith on the part of Warner Brothers, because if you have discretion and you actually intend to never use it, and you've bargained for that discretion, you're really not acting in good faith. When we discussed damages, one of the cases squibbed in the textbook was Parker versus 20th Century Fox, which dealt with Shirley MacLaine's contract to be the star of a musical film called Bloomer Girl. And when Fox decided not to produce the musical, it offered her a starring role in a Western. And the issue was whether an actress must accept any role that's offered to her in order to mitigate damages. And the court said no, because that other role may be inferior, and one does not have to accept an inferior job in order to mitigate damages. That's just a basic rule of employment law. And when we discussed this note in class, I was in the minority regarding judging the court's decision as being correct. And most of the class thought otherwise. And I was just thinking of all the gigs in my life where, let's say, like a big club defaulted and they offered a spot in the restaurant that they owned playing cover songs across town. And like, no way, that's you wouldn't take that. And having lived an artist's life for a while, I can say that the experience of being an artist, playing gigs, negotiating my own contracts has greatly informed the way that I view the law. And that is precisely what I wanted to get out of law school. And I'm glad I'm getting it. So the second semester of civil procedure was no less complex than the first, perhaps, at times, maybe being a little trickier and rule intensive. In the first semester, we juggled four or five rules under which a few manageable variables spun, albeit sometimes like an inception totem, but at least it was one rule within a few different frames. And in the second semester, the rules didn't go as deep, but there were maybe 40 or so different rules to juggle. And sometimes the rules coalesced well. Joinder, for example, had five or six sub-rules that informed a general efficiency mechanism. But by the same token, joinder did not play well with supplemental jurisdiction. Keeping those analyses separate was as good of an idea as not feeding a mogwai after midnight. As we made our way through the phases of trial, I became particularly interested in the ethics of what is called judicial gatekeeping. Less than 5% of all filed complaints go to trial, and of those 5% that actually make it to trial, the court can call off the verdict, order a new trial, or call off the trial itself. At first blush, this seemed to be sort of, violation of the Seventh Amendment right to trial. But really, if you get technical about it, the right to trial is merely, quote, preserved, end quote, and not guaranteed. And because juries try matters of fact and judges decide matters of law, if there are no facts in dispute, there's no need for a jury, and therefore there's no violation of the preserved right to a jury trial. But then the $64,000 question is, who decides whether a genuine issue of material fact exists? The judge. Now, to be sure, there are exacting standards, and a judge's decision on matters of fact, of law, are appealable writ large, but appeals take time and money, which are generally things people who are wronged don't have. I mean, we read a property case in a property class where two neighbors argued about whether a driveway was a prescriptive easement, and they took it all the way to the Supreme Court of Minnesota. And the cost of litigating a matter that could have been worked out with some rebar and a sawzall over a weekend was far more than a rational person would have spent. I guess the romantic idea of having one's day in court has substantial procedural and practical barriers. At the beginning of the semester, our professor announced that towards the end of the term, we would be having a civil procedure field day, which at first many of us were wondering if a physical component would somehow emerge. That didn't happen, but the field day ended up being a section-on-section Jeopardy-style match with a round of multiple-choice questions at the end rather than final Jeopardy. Before field day, individuals from each section could submit an original poem concerning one of the several approved topics. And I wrote a villanelle regarding the aforementioned judgment as a matter of law, one of the gatekeeping devices. Our section, Section 3, won the day, and I gotta say, that was the best field day since the free-for-all sprint-a-thon on the last day of the fourth grade, where I may have ran over 15 miles on accident. Academically, the biggest challenge for me this semester wasn't with the four doctrinal classes. It was with Lawyer 2, the writing class. Here, we only had to write two papers and give an oral argument, but the pace was so much faster than last semester. I almost always felt like, if you can imagine, Wile E. Coyote just out of reach of the Roadrunner with each subsequent draft. like some kind of Acme Corporation contraption gone wrong. And still, I think we all learned a lot. And the class was likely paced with real-life working conditions, so that was good. The first paper we wrote was a very short brief, which advocated for a persuasive position to the court. And the second paper, though, was a longer brief, a maximum of 14 pages. And the difference with this project was that the entire 1L class, that's eight different writing sections, had the exact same assignment. And we had just a little over a month to complete it. And by undergrad standards, 14 pages isn't too much. But by law school standards, 14 pages at first is almost not even enough to square an argument. And the art of legal writing is to say more with less, to convey complex ideas in understandable ways. And here, specifically with this assignment, to persuade. The topic we wrote on involved the tension between the purposes of what's called diversity jurisdiction in federal court and the citizenship rights of one who has been adjudicated incompetent or someone who can't think for themselves for medical reasons. One of the main reasons that parties in a lawsuit must be from different states in a federal court claim that doesn't involve federal law is to protect an out-of-state person from in-state bias. Now, determining citizenship requires two things. One, presence in the state, and two, an intent to remain there indefinitely. A person who can't form the intent to change citizenship is in what one court called a, quote, never-ending limbo, end quote, stuck in the last place that he could remember living. It made for a very interesting paper, and definitely there were arguments on both sides that were quite compelling. But after the paper was in, we participated in oral arguments within our section. The professor and two teaching assistants served as a panel of judges as if it were an actual appellate argument. And after the section arguments, we had the option of participating in a class-wide moot court competition, which took place just about up to final exams. I gave moot court an honest shot. It was fun, although the 6 p.m. start time after having been at school since 6 a.m. made it a bit tough for me to be on top of my game, and I'm trying not to make an excuse here, I didn't make the moot court team, and I was disappointed that I didn't, you know, make the quarterfinals, but really only for about 5 seconds because really there was barely enough time to study for exams, outline, and finish the reading for the semester. Overall, I think everyone would agree that the second semester of the first year was appreciably more difficult. The material was deeper, the reading load was heavier, searching for summer employment took a significant amount of time, and planning the rest of one's coursework for the remaining 2 years also took a while. One of the best distractions that some of us created was an informal Rubik's Cube club, and a few of us often found ourselves studying in the basement at the 7 a.m. hour. And what happened was Wake Law wrote a blurb about me in their admissions profile, and in the fine print, there was a mention that I had participated in a World Rubik's Cube Association tournament. And one of my classmates asked me if I could show him how I solved the cube. And then another classmate became interested. And then we had three, and then three is a crowd. And so I started them off with some charts of the Friedrich method, as well as a few pointers from my own experience with the puzzle. And we had a good time for a good part of the semester. And naturally, when work picked up around project time and exam time, we didn't meet. But it was fun to share this relatively useless information with my peers. I guess it's a good party trick to solve a Rubik's Cube in 30 seconds, but the skill's utility beyond that is likely limited. Fitness is quite difficult to maintain as a 1L. The problem's different for everyone, but the problem for me was a bit of your rock and a hard place scenario. To incorporate a 30-minute workout into my routine, I had to get up at 4 a.m. That's just the way my world works. And when I would get up that early, I found that when I was driving home at 4 p.m., I would be falling asleep at the wheel, and that's not safe. So around March, after a fairly consistent gym schedule since January, I stopped going to the gym altogether. I did try to walk as much as possible throughout the day and take the stairs, but still, it wasn't the same as getting to the gym. But while I was on spring break in Washington, D.C., Holly's cousin, Natalie, told us about this Whole 30 program that she had done earlier in the year. And it's sort of this whole food diet that restricts certain types of foods, but you don't worry about quantity. Anyway, I decided to try it for at least a month and see what happened. And it's weird. I found that, you know, it increased my energy levels and it helped curb some of the bonus weight that I picked up over the year. Interestingly, and I can't quite figure this out, but when I was on the diet, my allergies went away completely after 3 weeks. It was very strange. I don't know if there's some sort of link there, if it's a coincidence, but it was one of the worst allergy seasons in recent memory, and I didn't have the traditional symptoms. But anyway, it was kind of strange to be on this diet, though. One of my classmates asked me at lunch one day, "Why are you eating a whole package of meat?" It's a good question. It just seemed convenient. And another time, I took a spoon to a jar of almond butter and just ate it right before an exam. And someone looked at me with kind of a look and said, "Man, I respect that." And I'm not sure what that meant, but I guess it was a good idea. We'll see. But mainly this semester and over the past year, I think law school has forced me to examine my values. I explained in the last semester recap that the experience has compelled me to place a higher value on authentic expression, efficiency, seeking humility, and compassion. And I tried to act from these four values throughout the semester, and I considered it the four points of my moral compass. And I got mixed results. mainly, and the troublemaker is always authenticity, but being authentic can sometimes require a disregard for balance. And saying what you mean and meaning what you say can come at a price. You get to keep your spine, and at the end of the day, you can look yourself in the mirror without feeling like a sellout. But a lot of the time, I found that some of the answers that would score better and were labeled as having a sufficient depth, they seemed a bit too equivocal for my taste. And I think there's a difference between fully exploring both sides of an issue and trying to have it both ways. I'll just leave it at that. But it was weird. At one time, I was getting some peer feedback on some of my analysis, and one of the comments was that my argumentation was too professorial and unequivocal. And I think the student meant that as a critique, but for me, that was kind of a compliment. That's really what I think we should be trying to do, to not have it both ways. Anyway, efficiency remained a constant struggle. With more to do and less time to do it in, time management, I found, rose to the level of that would be required of a master craftsman. I began to use some different web-based programs with that Gantt projections and strict time cues that would okay, this is how long it's going to take you to do this and when you'll finish. But it became almost as much work to keep up with the charts as it was to study. So I felt like, okay, I'm overdoing it here. But during the last month of school, I did feel like I had everything dialed in really good in terms of balancing time management and being efficient. And but one thing I found that I want to speak up about is there's a movement among some pre-law programs and law coaching programs that they hold themselves out as arguing that you should never brief a case because they say it's a waste of time, and then of course they'll charge you an obscene amount of money for their own briefs that they've done or some exam tricks or whatever. But I disagree with this idea. I think briefing cases, provided that the brief is quote brief end quote, that is no more than a half page or so, it's really the heart of what we're doing here at law school, and it's how you understand argumentation and why the law is a process rather than words in a stone tablet. And you know, using some pre-made briefs can help at times understanding the basic idea if the case is really dense, and sometimes there's stuff that was written in 1850 that really just doesn't make any sense unless you have some sort of outline that tells you what it is you should be looking for. But I think the briefing is what always would prepare me for class and would help me be more efficient. And almost always, the professor is going to go deeper than the canned brief within the first three questions of a Socratic episode. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that in terms of efficiency, there really are no shortcuts in terms of analysis in law school. And I'm going to quote the Dread Pirate Roberts here, quote, "Anyone who tells you differently is either lying to you or trying to sell you something," end quote. Humility is a sword most often fallen upon. In the second semester, those of us who did their due diligence in finding out what we were getting into in the first place, we no longer had that element of surprise in terms of the exams and classes, but everyone in my section in some way was very smart. And I don't think you're doing law school right unless you're wrong and called out for it at least twice a day. The hard part is that, you know, in all of this, I can't think of a time in which I didn't prepare for class to the best of my ability, and still, sometimes it just wasn't enough. And walking out of a four-hour con law, exam, for example, only to have a three-hour property exam just 72 hours around the corner, felt like someone had put my brain in a mixing bowl with a dough hook. It was humbling. And compassion, I think, is easy to find if you're willing to be compassionate. You know, to some degree, everyone is struggling in law school. It's hard, okay? And for some students, the pie is a limited size, and it only diminishes when it's shared. And for others, the pie is limited, but it grows when shared. And I think I'm a second pie kind of guy. And whenever I help out somebody, it pays dividends. That the whole karma thing, it works. If you help, you receive help. And with compassion, I think part of understanding how others feel in law school specifically is recognizing how absurd the workload is and how downright funny it is to watch everyone, myself included, even attempt to keep up with it. I mean, I would often turn to a classmate in the library in the morning and ask, quote, "Which impossible to complete pile of work are you attempting to complete this morning?" End quote. George Carlin used to joke, quote, "The future isn't what it used to be," end quote. I'm excited about the future. I had the privilege of attending the Defenders of Justice Award in Durham not too long ago, and I got to hear some amazing stories of hope and strength and courage from six or seven Lifetime Achievement Award recipients. And they included two judges, a U.S. congressman, an attorney who was arguably responsible for the litigation that would ultimately overturn HB2, an attorney who has fought against the death penalty, and you know, a few other stories like that where people have devoted their lives to ensuring that the least members of society are just not swept under the rug so that those with the most can have just a bit more. In reflecting on this past semester, perhaps the largest epiphany I've had is that law school is meeting my need to express myself through writing and analysis. I think in doing some reflection that an unfulfilled need that I've had since graduating from college is the continuance of academic and intellectual challenges. I think that's why I took upon myself to learn how to solve a Rubik's Cube. I think that's why my website, which was once a music site and basically a music podcast, has drifted into esoteric and obtuse discussions of things that have very little to do with why you're probably listening to this in the first place. So, being so, I've recently redefined my website to better reflect my music rather than the broader receptacle of my interest. And I think another realization I've come to is that I need to be out in public playing music. That's something that I didn't do basically at all this past semester, and except there was one charity show I did where I played covers, and that was fun, but it just wasn't being an artist as much as I'm used to being. So I booked a handful of acoustic shows for the summer and the fall, and I really look forward to that. So that's what law school, the second semester, was like for me. It was challenging and stimulating and a lot of fun, but also very, very difficult. I was joking the other night that it's a lot like having children. You don't know what it's like until you actually do it. So I guess that's my perspective. But next time, I'll be back with a show. I think I'm going to do a reflection on Chris Cornell and his passing. Anyway, see you next time. The Mike Garrigan Podcast is brought to you by MikeGarrigan.com.